16. Jake stood outside the fence without moving for almost 2 minutes, surveying the vacant lot with dull eyes. One corner of his mouth twitched randomly. He could feel his hope, his absolute certainty, draining out of him. The feeling which was replacing it was the deepest, bitterest despair he had ever known. Just another false alarm, he thought when the shock had abated enough so he could think anything at all. Another false alarm, blind alley, dry well. Now the voices will start up again, and when they do, I think I'm going to start screaming. And that's okay, because I'm tired of toughing this thing out. I'm tired of going crazy. If this is what going crazy is like, then I just want to hurry up and get there so somebody will take me to the hospital and give me something that'll knock me out. I give up. This is the end of the line. I'm through. But the voices did not come back. At least not yet. And as he began to think about what he was seeing, he realized that the lot wasn't completely empty after all. Standing in the middle of the trash-littered, weedy waste ground was a sign. Mills Construction and Sombra Real Estate Associates are continuing to remake the face of Manhattan. Coming soon to this location, Turtle Bay Luxury Condominiums. Call 555-6712 for information. You will be so glad you did. Coming soon? Maybe. But Jake had his doubts. The letters on the sign were faded, and it was sagging a little. At least one graffiti artist, Bango Skank by name, had left his mark across the artist's drawing of the Turtle Bay Luxury Condominiums in bright blue spray paint. Jake wondered if the project had been postponed, or if it had maybe just gone belly up. He remembered hearing his father talking on the telephone to his business advisor not 2 weeks ago, yelling at the man to stay away from any more condo investments. "I don't care how good the tax picture looks," he nearly screamed. This was, as far as Jake could tell, his father's normal tone of voice when discussing business matters. The Coke in the desk drawer might have had something to do with that. "When they're offering a goddamn TV set just so you'll come down and look at a blueprint, something's wrong." The board fence surrounding the lot was chin-high to Jake. It had been plastered with handbills. Olivia Newton-John at Radio City, a group called G. Gordon Liddy and the Grots at a club in the East Village, a film called War of the Zombies, which had come and gone earlier that spring. No trespassing signs had also been nailed up at intervals along the fence, but most of them had been papered over by ambitious bill posters. A little way farther along, another graffito had been spray-painted on the fence, this one in what had once undoubtedly been a bright red, but which had now faded to the dusky pink of late summer roses. Jake whispered the words aloud, his eyes wide and fascinated. "See the turtle of enormous girth. On his shell he holds the earth. If you want to run and play, come along the beam today." Jake supposed the source of this strange little poem, if not its meaning, was clear enough. This part of Manhattan's east side was known, after all, as Turtle Bay. But that didn't explain the goose flesh, which was now running up the center of his back in a rough stripe, or his clear sense that he had found another road sign along some fabulous hidden highway. Jake unbuttoned his shirt and stuck his two newly purchased books inside. Then he looked around, saw no one paying attention to him, and grabbed the top of the fence. He boosted himself up, swung a leg over, and dropped down on the other side. His left foot landed on a loose pile of bricks that promptly slid out from under him. His ankle buckled under his weight, and bright pain lanced up his leg. He fell with a thud and cried out in mingled hurt and surprise as more bricks dug into his rib cage like thick, rude fists. He simply lay where he was for a moment, waiting to get his breath back. He didn't think he was badly hurt, but he'd twisted his ankle, and it would probably swell. He'd be walking with a limp by the time he got home. He'd just have to grin and bear it, though. He sure didn't have cab fare. "You don't really plan to go home, do you? They'll eat you alive." Well, maybe they would, and maybe they wouldn't. So far as he could see, he didn't have much choice in the matter. And that was for later. Right now, he was going to explore this lot, which had drawn him as surely as a magnet draws steel shavings. That feeling of power was still all around him, he realized, and stronger than ever. He didn't think this was just a vacant lot. Something was going on here, something big. He could feel it thrumming in the air, like loose volts escaping from the biggest power plant in the world. As he got up, Jake saw that he had actually fallen lucky. Close by was a nasty jumble of broken glass. If he'd fallen into that, he might have cut himself very badly. That used to be the show window, Jake thought. When the deli was still here, you could stand on the sidewalk and look in at all the meats and cheeses. They used to hang them on strings. He didn't know how he knew this, but he did, knew it beyond a shadow of a doubt. He looked around thoughtfully and then walked a little farther into the lot. Near the middle, lying on the ground and half buried in a lush growth of spring weeds, was another sign. Jake knelt beside it, pulled it upright, and brushed the dirt away. The letters were faded, but he could still make them out. Tom and Jerry's Artistic Deli. Party platters are specialty. And below it, spray-painted in that same red fading to pink, was this puzzling sentence. He holds us all within his mind. This is the place, Jake thought. Oh, yes. He let the sign fall back, stood up, and walked deeper into the lot, moving slowly, looking at everything. As he moved, that sensation of power grew. Everything he saw, the weeds, the broken glass, the clumps of bricks, seemed to stand forth with a kind of exclamatory force. Even the potato chip bag seemed beautiful, and the sun had turned a discarded beer bottle into a cylinder of brown fire. Jake was very aware of his own breathing and of the sunlight falling upon everything like a weight of gold. He suddenly understood that he was standing on the edge of a great mystery, and he felt a shudder, half terror and half wonder, work through him. It's all here. Everything is still here. The weeds brushed at his pants, burdock stuck to his socks. The breeze blew a ring-ding wrapper in front of him. The sun reflected off it, and for a moment the wrapper was filled with a beautiful, terrible inner glow. Everything is still here, he repeated to himself, unaware that his face was filling with its own inner glow. Everything. He was hearing a sound. Had been hearing it ever since he entered the lot, in fact. It was a wonderful, high humming, inexpressibly lonely and inexpressibly lovely. It might have been the sound of a high wind on a deserted plain, except it was alive. It was, he thought, the sound of a thousand voices singing some great open chord. He looked down and realized there were faces in the tangled weeds and low bushes and heaps of bricks. Faces! What are you? Jake whispered. Who are you? There was no answer, but he seemed to hear beneath the choir the sound of hoofbeats on the dusty earth and gunfire and angels calling hosannas from the shadows. The faces in the wreckage seemed to turn as he passed. They seemed to follow his progress, but no evil intent did they bear. He could see 46th Street and the edge of the UN building on the other side of First Avenue, but the buildings did not matter. New York did not matter. It had become as pale as window glass. The humming grew. Now it was not a thousand voices, but a million, an open funnel of voices rising from the deepest well of the universe. He caught names in that group voice, but could not have said what they were. One might have been Martin. One might have been Cuthbert. Another might have been Roland. Roland of Gilead. There were names. There was a babble of conversation that might have been 10,000 entwined stories, but above all was that gorgeous, swelling hum, a vibration that wanted to fill his head with bright, white light. It was, Jake realized, with a joy so overwhelming that it threatened to burst him to pieces, the voice of yes, the voice of white, the voice of always. It was a great chorus of affirmation, and it sang in the empty lot. It sang for him. Then, lying in a cluster of scrubby burdock plants, Jake saw the key. And beyond that, the rose. XVII. His legs betrayed him, and he fell to his knees. He was vaguely aware that he was weeping, even more vaguely aware that he had wet his pants a little. He crawled forward on his knees and reached toward the key lying in the snarl of burdocks. Its simple shape was one he seemed to have seen in his dreams. He thought, the little S-shape at the end, that's the secret. As he closed his hand around the key, the voices rose in a harmonic shout of triumph. Jake's own cry was lost in the voice of that choir. He saw the key flash white within his fingers and felt a tremendous jolt of power run up his arm. It was as if he had grasped a live high-tension wire, but there was no pain. He opened Charlie the Choo-Choo and put the key inside. Then his eyes fixed upon the rose again, and he realized that it was the real key, the key to everything. He crawled toward it, his face a flaming corona of light, his eyes blazing wells of blue fire. The rose was growing from a clump of alien purple grass. As Jake neared this clump of alien grass, the rose began to open before his eyes. It disclosed a dark scarlet furnace, petal upon secret petal, each burning with its own secret fury. He had never seen anything so intensely and utterly alive in his whole life. And now, as he stretched one grimy hand out toward this wonder, the voices began to sing his own name, and deadly fear began to steal in toward the center of his heart. It was as cold as ice and as heavy as stone. There was something wrong. He could feel a pulsing discord, like a deep and ugly scratch across some priceless work of art, or a deadly fever smoldering beneath the chilly skin of an invalid's brow. It was something like a worm, an invading worm, and a shape, one which lurks just beyond the next turn of the road. Then the heart of the rose opened for him, exposing a yellow dazzle of light, and all thought was swept away on a wave of wonder. Jake thought for a moment that what he was seeing was only pollen, which had been invested with the supernatural glow which lived at the heart of every object in this deserted clearing. He thought it even though he had never heard of pollen within a rose. He leaned closer and saw that the concentrated circle of blazing yellow was not pollen at all. It was a sun, a vast forge burning at the center of this rose growing in the purple grass. The fear returned, only now it had become outright terror. It's right, he thought, everything here is right, but it could go wrong, has started going wrong already, I think. I'm being allowed to feel as much of that wrongness as I can bear. But what is it? And what can I do? It was something like a worm. He could feel it beating like a sick and dirty heart, warring with the serene beauty of the rose, screaming harsh profanities against the choir of voices which had so soothed and lifted him. He leaned closer to the rose and saw that its core was not just one sun, but many. Perhaps all suns contained within a ferocious yet fragile shell. But it's wrong. It's all in danger. Knowing it would almost surely mean his death to touch that glowing microcosm, but helpless to stop himself, Jake reached forward. There was no curiosity or terror in this gesture, only a great, inarticulate need to protect the rose. 18. When he came back to himself, he was at first only aware that a great deal of time had passed, and his head hurt like hell. What happened? Was I mugged? He rolled over and sat up. Another blast of pain went through his head. He raised a hand to his left temple, and his fingers came away sticky with blood. He looked down and saw a brick poking out of the weeds. Its rounded corner was too red. If it had been sharp, I'd probably be dead or in a coma. He looked at his wrist and was surprised to find he was still wearing his watch. It was a Seiko, not terribly expensive, but in this city you didn't snooze in vacant lots without losing your stuff. Expensive or not, someone would be more than happy to relieve you of it. This time he had been lucky, it seemed. It was 4:15 in the afternoon. He had been lying here, dead to the world, for at least 5 hours. His father probably had the cops out looking for him by now, but that didn't seem to matter much. It seemed to Jake that he had walked out of Piper School about 1,000 years ago. Jake walked half the distance to the fence between the vacant lot and the Second Avenue sidewalk, then stopped. What exactly had happened to him? Little by little, the memories came back, hopping the fence, slipping and twisting his ankle. He reached down, touched it, and winced. Yes, that much had happened, all right. Then what? Something magical. He groped for that something like an old man groping his way across a shadowy room. Everything had been full of its own light. Everything, even the empty wrappers and discarded beer bottles. There had been voices. They had been singing and telling thousands of overlapping stories. And faces, he muttered. This memory made him look around apprehensively. He saw no faces. The piles of bricks were just piles of bricks, and the tangles of weeds were just tangles of weeds. There were no faces, but they were here. It wasn't your imagination. He believed that. He couldn't capture the essence of the memory, its quality of beauty and transcendence, but it seemed perfectly real. It was just that his memory of those moments before he had passed out seemed like photographs taken on the best day of your life. You can remember what that day was like, sort of, anyway, but the pictures are flat and almost powerless. Jake looked around the desolate lot, now filling up with the violet shadows of late afternoon, and thought, I want you back. God, I want you back the way you were. Then he saw the rose, growing in its clump of purple grass, very close to the place where he had fallen. His heart leaped into his throat. Jake blundered back toward it, unmindful of the beats of pain each step sent up from his ankle. He dropped to his knees in front of it like a worshipper at an altar. He leaned forward, eyes wide. It's just a rose. Just a rose, after all. And the grass... The grass wasn't purple after all, he saw. There were splatters of purple on the blades, yes, but the color beneath was a perfectly normal green. He looked a little further and saw splashes of blue on another clump of weeds. To his right, a straggling burdock bush bore traces of both red and yellow, and beyond the burdocks was a little pile of discarded paint cans. Glidden spread satin, the label said. That's all it was. Just splatters of paint. Only with your head all messed up the way it was, you thought you were seeing... That was bullshit. He knew what he had seen then and what he was seeing now. Camouflage, he whispered. It was all right here. Everything was. And it still is. Now that his head was clearing, he could again feel the steady harmonic power that this place held. The choir was still here, its voice just as musical, although now dim and distant. He looked at a pile of bricks and old broken chunks of plaster and saw a barely discernible face hiding within it. It was the face of a woman with a scar on her forehead. "Allie?" Jake murmured. "Isn't your name Allie?" There was no answer. The face was gone. He was only looking at an unlovely pile of bricks and plaster again. He looked back at the rose. It was, he saw, not the dark red that lives at the heart of a blazing furnace, but a dusty, mottled pink. It was very beautiful, but not perfect. Some of the petals had curled back. The outer edges of these were brown and dead. It wasn't the sort of cultivated flower he had seen in florist shops. He supposed it was a wild rose. "You're very beautiful," he said, and once more stretched his hand out to touch it. Although there was no breeze, the rose nodded toward him. For just a moment the pads of his fingers touched its surface, smooth and velvety and marvelously alive, and all around him the voice of the choir seemed to swell. "Are you sick, Rose?" There was no answer, of course. When his fingers left the faded pink bowl of the flower, it nodded back to its original position, growing out of the paint-splattered weeds in its quiet, forgotten splendor. "Do roses bloom at this time of year?" Jake wondered. "Wild ones? Why would a wild rose grow in a vacant lot anyway? And if there's one, how come there aren't more?" He remained on his hands and knees a little longer, then realized he could stay here looking at the rose for the rest of the afternoon, or maybe the rest of his life, and not come any closer to solving its mystery. He had seen it plain for a moment, as he had seen everything else in this forgotten, trash-littered corner of the city. He had seen it with its mask off and its camouflage tossed aside. He wanted to see that again, but wanting would not make it so. It was time to go home. He saw the two books he'd bought at the Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind lying nearby. As he picked them up, a bright silver object slipped from the pages of Charlie the Choo-Choo and fell into a scruffy patch of weeds. Jake bent, favoring his hurt ankle, and picked it up. As he did so, the choir seemed to sigh and swell, then fell back to its almost inaudible hum. "So that part was real, too," he murmured. He ran the ball of his thumb over the blunt, protruding points of the key and into those primitive V-shaped notches. He sent it skating over the mild S-curves at the end of the third notch. Then he tucked it deep into the right front pocket of his pants and began to limp back toward the fence. He had reached it and was preparing to scramble over the top when a terrible thought suddenly seized his mind. "The rose! What if somebody comes in here and picks it?" A little moan of horror escaped him. He turned back, and after a moment his eyes picked it out, although it was deep in the shadow of a neighboring building now, a tiny pink shape in the dimness, vulnerable, beautiful, and alone. "I can't leave it. I have to guard it." But a voice spoke up in his mind. A voice that was surely that of the man he had met at the way station in that strange other life. "No one will pick it. Nor will any vandal crush it beneath his heel because his dull eyes cannot abide the sight of its beauty. That is not the danger. It can protect itself from such things as those." A sense of deep relief swept through Jake. "Can I come here again and look at it?" he asked the phantom voice. "When I'm low, or if the voices come back and start their argument again, can I come back and look at it and have some peace?" The voice did not answer, and after a few moments of listening, Jake decided it was gone. He tucked Charlie the Choo-Choo and Riddledy Dum into the waistband of his pants, which he saw were streaked with dirt and dotted with clinging burdocks, and then grabbed the board fence. He boosted himself up, swung over the top, and dropped onto the sidewalk of Second Avenue again, being careful to land on his good foot. Traffic on the avenue, both pedestrian and vehicular, was much heavier now as people made their way home for the night. A few passers-by looked at the dirty boy in the torn blazer and untucked flapping shirt as he jumped awkwardly down from the fence, but not many. New Yorkers are used to the sight of people doing peculiar things. He stood there a moment, feeling a sense of loss, and realizing something else as well. The arguing voices were still absent. That, at least, was something. He glanced at the board fence, and the verse of spray-painted doggerel seemed to leap out at him, perhaps because the paint was the same color as the rose. "See the turtle of enormous girth," Jake muttered. "On his shell he holds the earth." He shivered. What a day, boy! He turned and began to limp slowly in the direction of home. The doorman must have buzzed up as soon as Jake entered the lobby, because his father was standing outside the elevator when it opened on the fifth floor. Elmer Chambers was wearing faded jeans and cowboy boots that improved his 5'10" to a rootin' tootin' 6 feet. His black crew-cut hair bolted up from his head. For as long as Jake could remember, his father had looked like a man who had just suffered some tremendous, galvanizing shock. As soon as Jake stepped out of the elevator, Chambers seized him by the arm. "Look at you!" His father's eyes flicked up and down, taking in Jake's dirty face and hands, the blood drying on his cheek and temple, the dusty pants, the torn blazer, and the burdock that clung to his tie like some peculiar clip. "Get in here! Where the hell have you been? Your mother's just about off her fucking gourd!" Without giving Jake a chance to answer, he dragged him through the apartment door. Jake saw Greta Shaw standing in the archway between the dining room and the kitchen. She gave him a look of guarded sympathy, then disappeared before the eyes of the mister could chance upon her. Jake's mother was sitting in her rocker. She got to her feet when she saw Jake, but she did not leap to her feet. Neither did she pelt across to the foyer so she could cover him with kisses and invective. As she came toward him, Jake assessed her eyes and guessed she'd had at least 3 Valiums since noon, maybe 4. Both of his parents were firm believers in better living through chemistry. "You're bleeding. Where have you been?" She made this inquiry in her cultured Vassar voice, pronouncing bean so it rhymed with scene. She might have been greeting an acquaintance who had been involved in a minor traffic accident. "Out," he said. His father gave him a rough shake. Jake wasn't prepared for it. He stumbled and came down on his bad ankle. The pain flared again, and he was suddenly furious. Jake didn't think his father was pissed because he had disappeared from school, leaving only his mad composition behind. His father was pissed because Jake had had the temerity to fuck up his own precious schedule. To this point in his life, Jake had been aware of only 3 feelings about his father: puzzlement, fear, and a species of weak, confused love. Now a 4th and 5th surfaced. One was anger, the other was disgust. Mixed in with these unpleasant feelings was that sense of homesickness. It was the largest thing inside him right now, weaving through everything else like smoke. He looked at his father's flushed cheeks and screaming haircut and wished he was back in the vacant lot, looking at the rows and listening to the choir. "This is not my place," he thought. "Not anymore. I have work to do. If only I knew what it was." "Let go of me," he said. "What did you say to me?" His father's blue eyes widened. They were very bloodshot tonight. Jake guessed he had been dipping heavily into his supply of magic powder, and that probably made this a bad time to cross him. But Jake realized he intended to cross him just the same. He would not be shaken like a mouse in the jaws of a sadistic tomcat. Not tonight. Maybe not ever again. He suddenly realized that a large part of his anger stemmed from one simple fact. He could not talk to them about what had happened, what was still happening. They had closed all the doors. "But I have a key," he thought, and touched its shape through the fabric of his pants. And the rest of that strange verse occurred to him. "If you want to run and play, come along the beam today." "I said let go of me," he repeated. "I've got a sprained ankle and you're hurting it." "I'll hurt more than your ankle if you don't." Sudden strength seemed to flow into Jake. He seized the hand clamped on his arm just below the shoulder and shoved it violently away. His father's mouth dropped open. "I don't work for you," Jake said. "I'm your son, remember? If you forgot, check the picture on your desk." His father's upper lip pulled back from his perfectly capped teeth in a snarl that was 2 part surprise and 1 part fury. "Don't you talk to me like that, mister. Where in the hell is your respect?" "I don't know. Maybe I lost it on the way home." "You spend the whole goddamn day absent without leave, and then you stand there running your fat, disrespectful mouth—" "Stop it! Stop it, both of you!" Jake's mother cried. She sounded near tears in spite of the tranquilizers perking through her system. Jake's father reached for Jake's arm again, then changed his mind. The surprising force with which his son had torn his hand away a moment ago might have had something to do with it. Or perhaps it was only the look in Jake's eyes.
"I want to know where you've been."
"Out. I told you that. And that's all I'm going to tell you."
"Fuck that. Your headmaster called. Your French teacher actually came here, and they both had beaucoup questions for you." "So do I, and I want some answers."
"Your clothes are dirty," his mother observed, and then added timidly, "Were you mugged, Johnny? Did you play hooky and get mugged?"
"Of course he wasn't mugged," Elmer Chambers snarled. "Still wearing his watch, isn't he?"
"But there's blood on his head." "It's okay, Mom. I just bumped it. But I'm going to bed. I'm very, very tired. If you want to talk about this in the morning, okay. Maybe we'll all be able to make some sense then. But for now, I don't have a thing to say."
His father took a step after him, reaching out. "No, Elmer!" Jake's mother almost screamed.
Chambers ignored her. He grabbed Jake by the back of the blazer.
"Don't you just walk away from me," he began,
and then Jake whirled, tearing the blazer out of his hand. The seam under the right arm, already strained, let go with a rough purring sound. His father saw those blazing eyes and stepped away. The rage on his face was doused by something that looked like terror. That blaze was not metaphorical. Jake's eyes actually seemed to be on fire. His mother gave voice to a strengthless little scream, clapped one hand to her mouth, took two large stumbling steps backward, and dropped into a rocking chair with a small thud.
"Leave me alone," Jake said. "What's happened to you?" his father asked, and now his tone was almost plaintive. "What in the hell's happened to you? You bug out of school without a word to anyone on the first day of exams, you come back filthy from head to toe, and you act as if you've gone crazy."
Well, there it was. You act as if you've gone crazy. What he'd been afraid of ever since the voices started 3 weeks ago, the dread accusation. Only now that it was out, Jake found it didn't frighten him much at all. Perhaps because he had finally put the issue to rest in his own mind. Yes, something had happened to him, was still happening. But no, he had not gone crazy. At least not yet.
"We'll talk about it in the morning," he repeated.
He walked across the dining room, and this time his father didn't try to stop him. He had almost reached the hall when his mother's voice, worried, stopped him.
"Johnny, are you all right?"
And what should he answer? Yes? No? Both of the above? Neither of the above? But the voices had stopped. And that was something. That was, in fact, quite a lot.
"Better," he said at last.
He went down to his room and closed the door firmly behind him. The sound of the door snicking firmly shut between him and all the rest of the round world filled him with tremendous relief. 20. He stood by the door for a little while, listening. His mother's voice was only a murmur, his father's voice a little louder. His mother said something about blood and a doctor. His father said the kid was fine, the only thing wrong with the kid was the junk coming out of his mouth, and he would fix that. His mother said something about calming down. His father said he was calm. His mother said, he said, she said, blah, blah, blah. Jake still loved them. He was pretty sure he did, anyway. But other stuff had happened now, and these things had made it necessary that still other things must occur. Why? Because something was wrong with the rose. And maybe because he wanted to run and play, and see his eyes again, as blue as the sky above the way station had been. Jake walked slowly over to his desk, removing his blazer as he went. It was pretty wasted, one sleeve torn almost completely off, the lining hanging like a limp sail. He slung it over the back of his chair, then sat down and put the books on his desk. He had been sleeping very badly over the last week and a half, but he thought tonight he would sleep well. He couldn't remember ever being so tired. When he woke up in the morning, perhaps he would know what to do. There was a light knock at the door, and Jake turned warily in that direction. "It's Mrs. Shaw, John. May I come in for a minute?" He smiled. Mrs. Shaw. Of course it was. His parents had drafted her as an intermediary. Or perhaps translator might be a better word. "You go see him," his mother would have said. "He'll tell you what's wrong with him. I'm his mother, and this man with the bloodshot eyes and the runny nose is his father, and you're only the housekeeper. But he'll tell you what he wouldn't tell us, because you see more of him than either of us, and maybe you speak his language." "She'll have a tray," Jake thought. And when he opened the door, he was smiling. Mrs. Shaw did indeed have a tray. There were two sandwiches on it, a wedge of apple pie, and a glass of chocolate milk. She was looking at Jake with mild anxiety, as if she thought he might lunge forward and try to bite her. Jake looked over her shoulder, but there was no sign of his parents. He imagined them sitting in the living room, listening anxiously. "I thought you might like something to eat," Mrs. Shaw said. "Yes, thanks." In fact, he was ravenously hungry. He hadn't eaten since breakfast. He stood aside, and Mrs. Shaw came in, giving him another apprehensive look as she passed, and put the tray on the desk.
"Oh, look at this," she said, picking up Charlie the Choo-Choo. "I had this one when I was a little girl. Did you buy this today, Johnny?"
"Yes. Did my parents ask you to find out what I'd been up to?" She nodded. No acting, no put-on. It was just a chore, like taking out the trash. "You can tell me if you want to," her face said, "or you can keep still. I like you, Johnny, but it's really nothing to me, one way or the other. I just work here, and it's already an hour past my regular quitting time." He was not offended by what her face had to say. On the contrary, he was further calmed by it. Mrs. Shaw was another acquaintance who was not quite a friend, but he thought she might be a little closer to a friend than any of the kids at school were, and much closer than either his mother or father. Mrs. Shaw was honest, at least. She didn't dance. It all went on the bill at the end of the month, and she always cut the crusts off the sandwiches. Jake picked up a sandwich and took a large bite. Bologna and cheese, his favorite. That was another thing in Mrs. Shaw's favor. She knew all his favorites. His mother was still under the impression that he liked corn on the cob and hated Brussels sprouts. "Please tell them I'm fine," he said. "And tell my father I'm sorry that I was rude to him." He wasn't, but all his father really wanted was that apology. Once Mrs. Shaw conveyed it to him, he would relax and begin to tell himself the old lie. He had done his fatherly duty, and all was well. All was well, and all manner of things were well. "I've been studying very hard for my exams," he said, chewing as he talked. "And it all came down on me this morning, I guess. I sort of froze. It seemed like I had to get out or I'd suffocate." He touched the dried crust of blood on his forehead. "As for this, please tell my mother it's really nothing. I didn't get mugged or anything. It was just a stupid accident. There was a UPS guy pushing a hand truck, and I walked right into it. The cut's no big deal. I'm not having double vision or anything, and even the headache's gone now." She nodded. "I can see how it must have been, a high-powered school like that and all. You just got a little spooked. No shame in that, Johnny. But you really haven't seemed like yourself this last couple of weeks." "I think I'll be okay now. I might have to redo my final essay in English, but..." "Oh!" Mrs. Shaw said. A startled look crossed her face. She put Charlie the Choo-Choo back down on Jake's desk. "I almost forgot. Your French teacher left something for you. I'll just get it." She left the room. Jake hoped he hadn't worried Mr. Bissett, who was a pretty good guy, but he supposed he must have, since Bissett had actually made a personal appearance. Jake had an idea that personal appearances were pretty rare for Piper school teachers. He wondered what Mr. Bissett had left. His best guess was an invitation to talk with Mr. Hotchkiss, the school shrink. That would have scared him this morning. But not tonight. Tonight only the rose seemed to matter. He tore into his second sandwich. Mrs. Shaw had left the door open, and he could hear her talking with his parents. They both sounded a little more cooled out now. Jake drank his milk, then grabbed the plate with the apple pie on it. A few moments later, Mrs. Shaw came back. She was carrying a very familiar blue folder. Jake found that not all of his dread had left him, after all. They would all know by now, of course, students and faculty alike, and it was too late to do anything about it. But that didn't mean he liked all of them knowing he had flipped his lid, that they were talking about him. A small envelope had been paper-clipped to the front of the folder. Jake pulled it free and looked up at Mrs. Shaw as he opened it. "How are my folks doing now?" he asked. She allowed herself a brief smile. "Your father wanted me to ask why you didn't just tell him you had exam fever. He said he had it himself once or twice when he was a boy." Jake was struck by this. His father had never been the sort of man to indulge in reminiscences which began, "You know, when I was a kid..." Jake tried to imagine his father as a boy with a bad case of exam fever, and found he couldn't quite do it. The best he could manage was the unpleasant image of a pugnacious dwarf in a Piper sweatshirt, a dwarf in custom-tooled cowboy boots, a dwarf with short black hair bolting up from his forehead. The note was from Mr. Bessant. "Dear John, Bonnie Avery told me that you left early. She's very concerned about you, and so am I, although we have both seen this sort of thing before, especially during exam week. Please come and see me first thing tomorrow, okay? Any problems you have can be worked out. If you're feeling pressured by exams, and I want to repeat that it happens all the time, a postponement can be arranged. Our first concern is your welfare. Call me this evening if you like. You can reach me at 555-7661. I'll be up until midnight. Remember that we all like you very much and are on your side. A votre sante, Len Bessant." Jake felt like crying. The concern was stated, and that was wonderful. But there were other things, unstated things in the note, that were even more wonderful. Warmth, caring, and an effort, however misconceived, to understand and console. Mr. Bessant had drawn a small arrow at the bottom of the note. Jake turned it over and read this. "By the way, Bonnie asked me to send this along. Congratulations." Congratulations? What in the hell did that mean? He flipped open the folder. A sheet of paper had been clipped to the first page of his final essay. It was headed "From the Desk of Benita Avery," and Jake read the spiky fountain-penned lines with growing amazement. "John, Leonard will undoubtedly voice the concern we all feel. He is awfully good at that, so let me confine myself to your final essay, which I read and graded during my free period. It is stunningly original, and superior to any student work I have read in the last few years. Your use of incremental repetition, and that is the truth, is inspired, but of course incremental repetition is really just a trick. The real worth of the composition is in its symbolic quality, first stated by the images of the train and the door on the title page, and carried through splendidly within. This reaches its logical conclusion with the picture of the Black Tower, which I take as your statement that conventional ambitions are not only false, but dangerous. I do not pretend to understand all the symbolism, e.g. Lady of Shadows, Gunslinger, but it seems clear that you yourself are the prisoner of school, society, etc., and that the educational system is the speaking demon. Is it possible that both Roland and the Gunslinger are the same authority figure? Your father, perhaps? I became so intrigued by this possibility that I looked up his name in your records. I note it is Elmer, but I further note that his middle initial is R. I find this extremely provocative. Or is this name a double symbol, drawn both from your father and from Robert Browning's poem, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came? This is not a question I would ask most students, but of course I know how omnivorously you read. At any rate, I am extremely impressed. Younger students are often attracted to so-called stream-of-consciousness writing, but are rarely able to control it. You have done an outstanding job of merging S of C with symbolic language. Bravo! Drop by as soon as you're back at it. I want to discuss possible publication of this piece in the first issue of next year's student literary magazine. B. Avery. P.S. If you left school today because you had sudden doubts about my ability to understand a final essay of such unexpected richness, I hope I have assuaged them. Jake pulled the sheet off the clip, revealing the title page of his stunningly original and richly symbolic final essay. Written and circled there in the red ink of Miss Avery's marking pen was the notation A+. Below this she had written, "Excellent job." Jake began to laugh. The whole day, the long, scary, confusing, exhilarating, terrifying, mysterious day was condensed in great, roaring sobs of laughter. He slumped in his chair, head thrown back, hands clutching his belly, tears streaming down his face. He laughed himself hoarse. He would almost stop, and then some line from Miss Avery's well-meaning critique would catch his eye, and he would be off to the races again. He didn't see his father come to the door, look in at him with puzzled, wary eyes, and then leave again, shaking his head. At last he did become aware that Mrs. Shaw was still sitting on his bed, looking at him with an expression of friendly detachment, tinctured with faint curiosity. He tried to speak, but the laughter pealed out again before he could. "I gotta stop," he thought. "I gotta stop or it's gonna kill me. I'll have a stroke or a heart attack or something." Then he thought, "I wonder what she made of choo-choo, choo-choo," and he began to laugh wildly again. At last the spasms began to taper off to giggles. He wiped his arm across his streaming eyes and said, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Shaw. It's just that, well, I got an A+ on my final essay. It was all very, very rich and very sim... But he couldn't finish. He doubled up with laughter again, holding his throbbing belly. Mrs. Shaw got up, smiling. "That's very nice, John. I'm happy it's all turned out so well, and I'm sure your folks will be, too. I'm awfully late. I think I'll ask the doorman to call me a cab. Good night, and sleep well." "Good night, Mrs. Shaw," Jake said, controlling himself with an effort. "And thanks." As soon as she was gone, he began to laugh again.